Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining our live stream on the latest escalation in the Middle East. We're more than 6 months removed from Hamas's attack on Israel. And since then, we've seen the continuation of Israel's ground operation Gaza, ongoing fighting on the border of Israel and Lebanon with Hezbollah, and exchanges with the Houthis in the Red Sea. But it wasn't until this month that the threat of a direct confrontation between Israel and Iran became imminent. Since Israel's April 1st airstrike in Damascus, the world has braced for a response from Iran, which finally came over the weekend. So today, we wanted to help our clients make sense of these latest developments, what could happen next, and what it all means for investments. So I'll start by hosting a discussion with Admiral James Stavridis, Vice Chair of Global Affairs at the Carlyle Group, who served previously as the 16th Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. After my conversation with Admiral Stavridis, I'll be joined by two of my CIO colleagues, Jay Dobson, our energy and utilities sector strategist, as well as Paul Donovan, our chief economist, to break down what the implications are for oil prices, the economy, the Fed, and more. So without further delay, I will kick off with Admiral Stavridis. Well, thank you for being here with us today. And of course, thank you so much for your incredible service to the country.
My pleasure to be with UBS today.
Thank you. So, Admiral, I want to start by going back to Iran's attack over the weekend. On one hand, it was unprecedented as the first attack ever launched from Iranian soil on Israel. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, some have expressed it was mostly a spectacle that was designed to avoid real damage. What's your take on this?
I think it's somewhere in the middle, which is to say the structure of the attack by sending 170 drones on the front end, effectively you give the air defenders an immense amount of time. You mentioned I was Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. In my naval career, I was principally an air defense officer operating guided missile destroyers, some of whom, by the way, participated in defending Israel. So that drone wave gave a lot of heads up. It was followed by cruise missiles, ballistic missiles. Overall, it was a significant package, but it was not one that was A, likely to get through in significant ways, and B, it was not going to inflict a massive amount of damage. I'll close with this, Salida. If you are in the target zone and you see 300 drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles, you are very concerned, and you should be. In this case, the air defenders did, frankly, a brilliant job knocking all that down. I think the Iranians, if they could desire perfection, they would have gotten through a small number of the, say, the ballistic missiles against targets deep in the south of Israel, where Israel has its high-end Air Force units, the F-35s. So I think they would have liked a couple of hits, but as it turns out, it was a very good day for the air defenders.
Yes, and to your point, I mean, the next day when we, you know, found out that there was not much damage except one unfortunate young girl, 10-year-old, and people were, you know, almost dancing on the streets, but the night before when we spoke live with our contacts in Israel, it was a pretty difficult evening. It was a very scary, difficult evening, even though, obviously, there wasn't much of a damage. So, you know, for the majority of our listeners who probably don't have a military background, can you maybe describe the weapons that were used by Iran, how they work, and how Israel's defense system was able to successfully protect against them?
Yeah, I'll do this very quickly. I think most people appreciate what a drone is, an unmanned air vehicle. These were relatively small that had smaller explosive packages in them. And the key to understanding drones, as I mentioned earlier, these are very slow. So Israel had plenty of time to be aware of over the 1,000 miles that separate Tehran and Jerusalem. So slow, small, but big numbers, 170 of those. The cruise missiles, kind of next level of threat, are air breathers, we call them. They process air through their motor. They move faster than the drones. Some of them can approach the speed of sound, but it's still going to be a fair amount of warning for those cruise missiles. So you've got hours with the drones. You've got an hour of cruise missile time as it comes across. The real threat is from ballistic missiles. These are very fast. They go much faster than the speed of sound. They go up into the air, achieve velocity, come back down. Very hard target for the air defenders. So when you package those three things together, the air defenders are looking for the drones, lighting up their radars, syncing everything together in the surveillance side of things, and finally starting to shoot their missiles back to knock down these incoming threats. Pretty high level of threat, very well handled, and worth mentioning, not just Israel. U.S. assets, I mentioned guided missile destroyers and cruisers earlier. Additionally, American Patriots around the Middle East. Additionally, Jordan participated in launching missiles to help defend. France and the United Kingdom were part of the surveillance and the command and control. So it really was a team effort, and that was required to deal with an attack of that scale.
Yes. And you mentioned all the coordination, and I guess coordination with the U.S. and its allies as part of defense was expected. But I think the Jordan's participation was quite a surprise to many because it is home to many Palestinians. I mean, what do you make of this? Was this an expectation of yours? Were you surprised as well? And what does this mean going forward?
No, I was not surprised. Jordan has had robust diplomatic relations with Israel for decades, as has Egypt. What surprised me, and you don't see a lot of reporting about this, but fairly clearly, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, UAE, other Arab states were involved in the surveillance side of this thing. I don't think they would have launched any missiles. That would have surprised me. But if you look at the trends in the Middle East, clearly Israel is drawing closer and closer to the Arab nations, even those with whom they do not as yet enjoy diplomatic relations. In fact, Salida, if you go wind the clock back pre-October 7th, part of the motivation for Hamas, the answer to the why now question, was Hamas was watching the kingdom and Israel come closer and closer to diplomatic relations. So that's a mega trend in the Middle East, Israel working with the Arabs, and they're going to be lined up against Iran. So no, I was not surprised to see that alignment carried out quite publicly by the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan.
Okay. Maybe looking ahead, obviously all eyes are now on Israel and how they will respond. What do you think their options are, and what might be seen as a proportioned response versus an escalatory one? And maybe in terms of timing, do you think we are talking about hours, days, weeks?
Let's begin by putting ourselves into the conversations in the War Cabinet of Israel. They are receiving briefings that lay out a package of options right now. And we'll go from the bottom to the highest level. So at the very bottom would be do nothing. Take the win, as President Biden says. Kind of ride the sympathy wave for Israel that's been generated by the fact that they were the ones attacked. I think we can throw that option out. The Israeli War Cabinet has already indicated there will be a response. Next up would be a package of fairly non-kinetic activities. That could include a cyber attack, for example, which I think would be a smart play on the part of the Israelis. Go after the Iranian economy, their banking system, their finances internationally, a fairly robust cyber attack. and perhaps couple that with additional sanctions. That's kind of what the U.S. is pushing Israel towards. So that's kind of option two. Option three, one above that, would be kinetic, using missiles, bombs, aircraft. And here at that level, you would go after Iranian military outside of Iran. So the proxy supporters working with the Hezbollah and Hamas, go after those Iranians outside. And you might also, in that tranche of options, go after an Iranian warship at sea. And by the way, 3 days ago, the Iranian Navy seized a merchant ship with financial ties to Israel. So I think that level of kinetic response, Alita, is quite proportional. And I think that's where Israel will land here. Fourth, you could go a more robust series of targets inside Iran. Here, you might go after the munitions facilities where these drones were constructed, where they're operated, but a relatively tight target set. Fifth and finally, I don't expect this. If it does turn to this, then look for a wider war to really develop. But fifth and finally, the Israelis could, so to speak, go big, use their air force, their cruise missiles, and go after a very wide range of targets against the Iranian military industrial complex. I don't expect option one, kind of do nothing. I don't expect option five, go big. Where I think this lands is look for a cyber, something maritime, and one or two fairly precise strikes inside Iran.
Inside Iran. Okay, so you mentioned Biden's suggestions is out the door. And because he said, you know, don't respond. And maybe you said the fifth option is unlikely, but somewhere in between, as Israel responds, how do you expect then the U.S. to be involved moving forward?
I think the United States will not be involved, and we've already signaled this clearly, in a kinetic strike, missiles, bombs. The United States, however, I think offstage would probably be involved in a, for example, offensive cyber attack. Certainly, you've already seen this morning the administration talking about new sanctions that are going to be applied. So the U.S. will push for and support non-kinetic, but probably not jump into a kinetic response with the Israelis.
Okay. Do you see a different approach by Western nations, considering it is reported that Iran is capable of building an atomic bomb in weeks or months? And along those lines, do you think an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities is in the cards in the near or long term? Because you said it might be very targeted inside Iran. Would these nuclear facilities would be a part of it?
I think it's unlikely that we'll see a major strike against Iranian nuclear facilities in the immediate future. Longer term, Israel would say, and I would tend to agree with them, a nuclear-armed Iran is simply unsupportable for them, considering that the Ayatollahs constantly talk about completely destroying the state of Israel. So you couple that stated intent with actual deliverable nuclear weapons, that's a point at which Israel will strike. And I suspect at that point, the United States may well participate in that. That's in the future. Iran is getting closer to being able to have enough enriched uranium weapons grade to produce one or two bombs. That's still a year or two to making them deliverable on a missile system. So there's still time to kind of curb this this threat. But it is looming out there in the distance, and it's worth watching that space. I think as investors, the Iranian nuclear program is a kind of an indicator of where Iran is going, broadly speaking. Mm-hmm.
And if we see continued escalation, Admiral, can the defense systems of Israel hold up against a multi-front war with Iran and its proxies, or would they need more from the U.S.?
Yeah, let's kind of hypothesize What are the chances of a wider war, and what would it look like? So I think here's modest good news. I think there's about an 80, 85% chance that we do not head into a larger, wider war, that being defined as Iran, Israel, continuing to launch attacks, these attacks getting bigger, and the United States being dragged into it. I think 85% chance things will come down a bit. And the reason is because Iran doesn't want a broader war because they'll get the worst of it. Their military would be ultimately defeated by a combination of Israel and the United States. And the administration here in the United States desperately doesn't want it during an election year. And the Israelis, your point, kind of have their hands full right now with Hamas. They've called up almost their entire reserve forces, and they've got a looming threat to the north of Hezbollah, which has not a few hundred air vehicles, but tens of thousands, probably 120,000 missiles just north of Israel. So 85% chance as a result of low motivation, we don't get to a wider war. How about that 15%? What does that look like? It looks as a result of, let's say, a very big Israeli strike. Then Iran responds, both from Iran, but also unleashing Hezbollah, a lot of missiles coming in. That's existential to any number of Israeli significant targets. That's the point at which the president of the United States has a tough decision, but probably sends a couple of carriers over there and helps Israel take on Hezbollah. You'll see a wave of terrorism as a result of that globally. That's a pretty dark scenario. Fortunately, it's only a 10 to 15% chance of actually appearing. But I think it's the biggest risk I'm watching right now.
Okay. And maybe coming to the topic of the proxy wars, you know, it seems the U.S. or Israel have not yet been effective in deterring attacks from the Houthis in the Red Sea. What else do you think they can do on this front?
Yeah, you're asking an admiral the right question. obviously, I've been very focused on the shipping part of this, as have been investors. I think roughly half of the shipping that normally passes through the Red Sea and therefore through the Suez Canal has been disrupted. You're seeing some prices kind of rise as a result of that, simply because the ships are avoiding the area, about half of them, and they now go around the Cape of Good Hope down on the southern part of Africa. That costs more to get them to do that in terms of fuel, crew time, et cetera. That'll drive prices up, you know, kind of modestly. But the idea that we can allow a group of Iranian proxy actors to simply shut down one of the world's major sea lanes of communication, in my view, is preposterous. We have given Iran a significant amount of warning about this. We are launching aggressive attacks, we being a Western coalition, including the United States and about a dozen other nations. Mm-hmm. We're escorting ships through the region, and we're actually striking Houthi maritime targets, both at sea and ashore. So you ask, okay, they're still not stopping. What's the next step? It's a more aggressive campaign going ashore, but going after a larger set of Houthi targets, including their military capability on the ground, not necessarily tied to their nefarious maritime activity. So you up the ante. If that doesn't get the attention of the Houthis, then I think you have to go to the puppet master. And here you'd have to go after Iran and their proportionality again, go after their maritime infrastructure, probably a warship or two at sea. They have a couple spy vessels that are providing targeting for these operations. You could go after their bases. You go after their resupply ships that are bringing more weapons to the Houthis. We're not there yet. And the attacks have diminished over the last few weeks because of the drumbeat of attack by the West. So I think we're probably going to watch the Houthis during this period, see if they continue to decline attacks, get them to a manageable level. If that doesn't work, go ashore against Houthi. If that doesn't work, go ashore against Iran. Let's hope we don't get to that.
A pretty comprehensive checklist.
Exactly.
Now, of course, all of this is taking place while Israel is still conducting its ground operation in Gaza. And Israel continues to face a dilemma here, right? The global community continues to caution against an invasion of Rafah. Yet Israel believes this is a critical step in achieving its goal of eliminating Hamas. What do you expect to happen next there?
The Israelis ultimately are going to go into Rafah. The question is, what is the manner of the attack and what have they done in advance to reduce and eliminate to the degree they can collateral damage to the civilian population? As most folks will know, over a million Gazans are packed into Rafah. There are also, you get different reports, but I'd say 8,000 Hamas fighters in tunnels underground. What the Israelis are going to have to do is find a way to move that Gazan population probably back to the north, to areas where they have secured and decommissioned the tunnel system in the north. That'll take weeks, if not months, to do that. It's an extremely complex problem. Once they have shifted the vast majority of those civilians out of the line of fire, then they will go into Rafah. And by the way, they will do all they can to eliminate the Hamas fighters. Mm-hmm. The military center of gravity is actually the tunnel complex.
Yeah.
400 miles of tunnel. This is where Hamas lives, operates, trains, equips, launches all of their operations. Israel will flood those, blow them up, seal them off. Once they do that, Hamas is living above ground, quite exposed. That threat will go down significantly over time. So look for the Israelis to try and move the majority of the population, then go in a fairly targeted way, destroying the tunnel complex as they go in. No civilians down in those tunnels. So I think that's the way they'll approach it. Hopefully, I'll conclude with this. Hopefully, they'll communicate all that very clearly and transparently to the international community. They need to do that. Because in that sense, they're losing the narrative, losing the information war.
Yeah, to a point, I mean, as much as it is an on-the-ground war, this has proven to be a major information war, right?
Yeah.
And it's not one. Maybe they might be winning on the ground, but the information war, maybe it's the law of the numbers. There is definitely more numbers flooding the broadcasting channels from the other side. You've been very generous with your time, so I only have one question left for you, Admiral. We know that geopolitical events often have ripple effects, and one we're watching closely here is the impact on the war in Ukraine. Any thoughts here?
Yes. The principal effect, unfortunately for the Ukrainians, is distraction away from the events of Ukraine and the illegal, immoral, vicious invasion of Ukraine. Suddenly, the world's attention has been swiveled to the Middle East, understandably.
Yeah.
However, the war continues there. As President Zelensky has said in the last few days, looking enviously at the air defense of Israel, his comment is, where's my air defense? And he's got a pretty good point to be made there. So hopefully the geopolitical impact will be one of causing the United States to step up and provide the additional aid to Ukraine. But for the moment, Salida, Ukraine is disadvantaged by events in the Middle East.
Yeah. And of course, it's not their luck that it's also an election year where all these things are happening.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you, Admiral Stavridis. We really, really appreciate you spending time with us today. And I know you're on vacation and took time from your vacation to join us. It means a lot. Thank you. Feel free to stay on if you would like, or otherwise, We'll let you go back. And now I'm going to bring in my CIO colleagues, Jay Dobson and Paul Donovan, to discuss the macro and market impact. Jay, welcome. Thank you for being here in the studio, so I don't feel so alone. maybe starting with you from an investment standpoint, the main concern stemming from Middle East tensions comes in the form of obviously higher oil prices, and all eyes are on any supply disruptions, particularly in the Strait of Hormuz, which we know accounts for about 20% of global oil flows. What are you watching most closely here, and how high could the prices go?
Yeah, Selena, it's a really good question, and we really have to frame it. If you think of global oil supply, about 30%, really more than 30% of global oil supply comes out of the Middle East. And as you point out, things like the Strait of Hormuz and others are choke points that could, you know, further complicate things. So when we talk about oil prices reacting to geopolitical events, as Admiral Stavridis was just talking about, they're really reacting to supply risks. So as we've seen over the last 30 or 45 days, oil prices have risen because people have been concerned what could potentially happen to supply. So when you ask what we're watching for supply risks. If we stare at the market right now, it looks moderately or modestly undersupplied. So we would be, you know, at risk of supply disruption. The other thing to keep in mind really is, you know, the spare capacity. And when I say spare capacity, the oil that could quickly be brought to the market in response to supply disruptions, most of that is in the Middle East. So we've really got to watch that arena very carefully, but we're watching supply. When you say how high could prices go, you know, I think they could trend as high as 120, certainly looking back to the Russia-Ukraine example in 2022, that's sort of the price level. You also have to keep in mind that, you know, when prices go high, you know, it tends to destroy demand or reduce demand, so you have that offsetting impact there. But as Admiral Stavridis just said, hopefully, and I hope it as a human being, 80-85% chance that this is going to go lower, so we should see actually oil prices, you know, over time trend lower.
Lower. Now, given the U.S. is now the world's largest producer of oil, does a disruption in oil supplies in Middle East matter as much, and, you know, would this feed through to higher gas prices at the pump here?
Yeah, it's another really good question, and one I think that's misunderstood. I mean, at the end of the day, oil is a global commodity. Yeah. So though we're, you know, the largest producer globally, all that really means is we still have that global price, but more of those dollars stay here in the U.S. versus being exported. So higher oil prices would mean higher oil prices here in the U.S. Higher oil prices here in the U.S. would mean higher gasoline. And another thing that's really important to recognize is the infrastructure in the U.S., you know, isn't sufficient. So, for example, we're sitting here in New York. The marginal barrel of gasoline here on the East Coast is imported from Europe. So it really highlights this is a sort of global commodity, both oil and refined products. The other thing I'd mention is, you know, when you think about gasoline, a lot of people say, well, the refiners are gouging price. We're short refining capacity globally. In periods of high prices, though, you hear from politicians in the media about refiners, they have a big incentive to run very hard and produce as much supply as they actually can if you believe that we're in a global commodity market. So I think gasoline prices would react higher. I think we will see probably slightly higher than last summer gasoline prices this summer. But crossing our fingers, and hopefully over time we see oil prices and hence gasoline prices moderating, particularly in an election year.
Now, many of our clients, investors, are exposed to oil or energy in general through the equity market, through energy stocks. So what does this all mean in terms of our outlook for energy?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, when you think of energy equities, they tend to respond to oil prices. They're driven by a lot of things, but the main one is oil prices. So, you know, when we look at the last 40 days or 45 trading days, you know, energy equities have gone from being almost the worst performer to the best performer in the market. Yeah. And, you know, that's been driven again by whether we're talking supply or geopolitical risks, what's driven oil prices higher. So I would say, you know, we've been, you know, a little surprised because we don't predict geopolitical events as well as we'd like to, that oil has done what it's done. But I would say we have a neutral view on energy equities. And I think certainly given where oil prices are right now, that's the right answer. I know a number of our clients remain still a little overweight. So I'd use this opportunity to probably trim some positions in anticipation of, you know, lower prices or trending lower oil prices as we get toward the end of 2024. But look, I still think energy equities have a very, very good place long term, particularly with the energy transition in a diverse equity portfolio.
Any specific sector within energy that you like?
Yeah, we like the refining sector for a lot of the reasons I mentioned before. I always think it's a great hedge when we're all going to the gasoline station and filling up to own those refiners. You know, it helps us pay for those somewhat sometimes inconveniently higher prices. We also like the integrated oils. The exploration and production companies, again, are the most sensitive to higher oil prices. So those are the ones I'd probably be most careful with right here.
Okay, thank you. In the interest of time, I'm going to turn to the UK, Paul. Thank you again for joining us. You know, this is all taking place right while we're also seeing negative surprises with the latest CPI prints. We had Powell talking about it yesterday, finally recognizing. How does this further complicate the inflation picture?
Well, I think this is a slightly more complicated situation. So the so-called negative surprises on inflation, on CPI, this has been mainly owner's equivalent rent, which is a housing measure, and it's a price nobody actually pays. So the reality of the inflation experience in the United States has not actually been surprising that negatively. But if we see further increases in prices at the gasoline pumps, that then is a real price increase. That is something that affects people. And it's an additional problem because it affects inflation perceptions even more. People feel more negative about life when high frequency purchases go up in price. So, you know, this is generally speaking food and fuel. You know, if the price of a Snickers bar goes up, I notice it because, you know, Snickers are the main source of nutrition for your average economist. If the price of diesel goes up, I've got to spend more to put fuel into my Land Rover. That again is a price that I remember. So I think the issue here is that the inflation perception is possibly going to go higher as pump prices go up. And of course, if pump prices come down, then people feel a little bit better about life.
Okay. And if the inflation rises due to high oil prices, will the Fed, from your perspective, look through this, or could it further delay rate cuts this year?
So,
and I know we debate this all
day long. If I was running the Fed, I would look through this. But I'm an economist, so I'm trained to look through noise because this won't last very long. It won't last forever. It's a temporary shock. The Powell Fed, I'm less confident about that. And that's simply because Powell has been, in my view, a lot more political. I don't mean politically biased, but I mean he's been a lot more political, a lot less economic in some of his analysis. He's obsessing about consumer price inflation, which is not a great number to obsess about. And I think that he may further delay rate cuts. I don't think would raise rates, but I think may further delay rate cuts if you were to get an oil-induced spike in headline CPI.
Okay. And right now, our call is still for two cuts this year, starting later in the year. But this is obviously we spent the whole last half an hour talking about the Middle East. This is something we're watching very closely, whether that call is going to change or not. Paul, I want to move to one of your other favorite topics around trade. You know, how could higher oil prices or disruptions in trade routes impact different economies around the world?
So with higher oil prices, the impact is not necessarily that significant to overall economic activity. I think at this stage, though, we would have to say higher oil prices are more likely to be demand destructive than they are to be price inflationary. So you've got two possible impacts from higher oil prices. One is prices go up, but people find the money to pay for the extra fuel costs and they carry on consuming. And that's where we were in 2022 after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But now I think people don't have quite the same savings level that they have. There's not quite the same sort of rush to the shopping mall that there was. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. You guys over in the States are still rushing out and spending money you don't have on things you don't need, but it's not quite as fervent as it was. And so I think this would be more about demand destruction because you're having to put more of the family budget into paying for fuel. Now, on the trade side, that I think is important because whilst the disruption to trade is increasing shipping costs aren't that important. When we look at the price of a good sold in America, an imported good sold in America or in Europe, we are generally seeing less than 5%, significantly less than 5% of the price the consumer pays is actually going to shipping costs. So whilst this is disruptive, and it certainly disrupts the shipping industry, I don't think that translates into consumers' pockets in quite the same way.
Okay. And Paul, I blame my daughter for shopping from Sephora all the time for things she doesn't need. You're absolutely, she's a good stats for you. One last Excellent. Question for you. Zooming out, look, it's clear that elevated geopolitical tensions are here to stay as a byproduct of the multipolar world we're in. Any broader economic implications you want to touch from this?
So my view, sadly, is that in a world of increased economic disruption, what economists call the fourth industrial revolution, some people do better, some people do worse. This is just natural in periods of enormous structural upheaval. When people do worse in this situation, they look for someone to blame. But my fault, things are going wrong. Whose fault is it? And you get what we call scapegoat economics and then prejudice politics. And unfortunately, I'm afraid to say, one of the most convenient groups to blame is the foreigner. Because they're different. They're not like us. And so we see this rise of economic nationalism. And I'm afraid to say, I believe this is going to be a recurring feature. You know, the geopolitical tensions that we've got now are one very extreme manifestation of economic nationalism. But this is going to come back again and again and again, because it is always easy to blame the foreigner.
Yeah, we probably could have a whole hour of live stream just on that. And maybe we should do it. It's really
absolutely
interesting, big implications, and of course topical in an election year as well. Anyway, I'm giving signals that you know, the time is up. So thank you so much to both of you for that read on the implications for the economy and oil prices, and even broader, Paul, around economic nationalism. I wanted to maybe add a few final thoughts to close. First and foremost, it's always an important reminder that while geopolitical events bring uncertainty, they typically represent market interruptions, not necessarily inflection points for investments. If you look back at major geopolitical shocks since World War II, the S&P 500 has been higher 1 year after about 70% of the time. Now, of course, you know, we might see more volatility in the near term. We talked a lot about the complexities that we're living in with all the three speakers as equities digest not only developments in the Middle East, but also data points around inflation and Fed policy. Valuations are extended, which makes stocks more sensitive to any negative news on these fronts. But overall, the economy remains on a very solid footing. I don't even want to say we don't believe a recession is imminent. I haven't heard that word in a long time. And we think earnings growth should be supportive this year as well, which we're already seeing signs of it during the first quarter reporting, which we're in the middle of. So it's still time to stay invested in line with your long-term strategic asset allocation targets. This is, you know, all the time that we have for now. We could talk a lot more. But as always, I would encourage you to reach out to your UBS financial advisors to continue the conversation. I hope you found the event insightful, and thank you for spending the past 45 minutes with us. Have a great day.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, countries and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.